Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dovere. Today's guest, Rob Reiner, the actor, activist, director, all-around talkative guy. We sat down in New York, and he had opinions on all sorts of things, including Russia, his new movie about Lyndon Johnson coming up, and, of course, the role that celebrities and people who have very strong opinions about what's going on in politics have right now. Remember to subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Email me at isaacdovere@politico.com and follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Isaac Dovere. And now, my conversation with Rob Reiner. So I feel like we should start with the Archie Bunker question and get that out of the way. Last year, you said that you thought Archie Bunker would vote for Trump.
Yes. I
wonder what you think, and you're not, Norman Lear is maybe the authority on Archie Bunker,
yeah.
Certainly Carol Kahn was,
yeah.
But you were around for a lot of that. Do you think he would be, is that kind of voter the type of voter who would not be moved from supporting Trump so far? Where is that Archie Bunker voter?
You know, that's a great question, because what we've discovered, certainly over the last, I guess, 9 months now, is that his core supporters don't, you know, what he said during the campaign is, I could shoot somebody in Fifth Avenue, no, I wouldn't lose any voters. And that is essentially true. I mean, there has been probably some small erosion around the edges. There may continue to be erosion. I mean, we do see people burning the Make America Great hats again. You know,
not a lot of those people.
Not a lot, but there's some of that. When they discover that he's using their campaign funds for legal fees, that might have a little, make a little dent, but we don't see a lot of it. So, that's a great question. I don't know if Archie would abandon Trump at this point.
The reason, in part, why I ask it is because of what you're working on with this new group, which is in. It seems like the theory behind it is that not a lot of people have a full understanding of what happened with Russia,
right.
And that it's hard for people to grapple with and process the information.
Right.
It seems like some of that, when you look at the polling of where the Republican base is still, for all of the slippage that Trump has had with independents and others, among the Republican base, he's still at 80-90%. And some of those are going to be those kind of Archie Bunker type voters,
right,
who you, I would imagine, want to break through to also. Right?
We'd like to break through. You're exactly right. I think that when their standard bearer is refuting the fact that the Russians did, in fact, invade us during the 2016 election, it makes it a much more difficult argument to make, even though you have, as they, you know, always say, 17, intelligence, organizations saying that that did happen. And we know it happened. It's now a fact. It's not something to be argued. But the problem that we have is that since this whole idea of fake news has been perpetrated on the American public, it's very hard to break through with real news. But
tell me about it.
Yeah, no, I can understand. And that's the real reason we're trying this, only because there has been tremendous coverage on the Russians' interference in our 2016 election. Politico, your organization, has done it. New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. I mean, all the networks have covered it. And yet, for some reason, there's a big chunk of America that just refuses to believe it, or, you know, thinks that there's the 500-pound guy sitting on his bed somewhere. So the thing that has been very frustrating to me, and I've said this before, is that in the past, we've always come together as a country when we've been attacked by a foreign enemy, you know, whether it was Pearl Harbor or 9/11, we've always come together, Republicans and Democrats. It's all, you know, the classic cliche of politics ending at the water's edge has always been in place. And for this, for the first time, is not so. And I think it's because the standard bearer refuses to accept it or believe it or want to acknowledge it because it possibly could, in his mind, delegitimize his presidency. But you have to think, hopefully, beyond this is not about Donald Trump. What we're trying to do is not about Donald Trump, because Donald Trump's going to be off the national stage in, you know, before it's 4 years, 8 years, or, you know, 2 months, depending on what happens. We don't know. But the country has been around for 241 years. And if our democracy is going to survive, we need to shore up the institutions and the people who are living in those institutions.
I mean, it's also because maybe it's hard to fully process what a cyber attack looks like. There were lots of ways that this went on. It's different from Pearl Harbor. It's different. Yes. You compared it to an atom bomb the other day.
Yeah, if we saw a bomb drop, there would be no argument. We'd all say, hey, who dropped that bomb? And let's get those guys, or, you know, let's protect ourselves. This is the new battlefield that we're playing on. Cyber warfare is new, and it is tricky because we don't feel it. We don't see it. Yet it happens. We know it can happen. We ourselves in America have been able to work with the Israeli intelligence in disrupting Iran's nuclear program with Stuxnet. And we know about this. This is not, you know, we're not saying something we don't know. So we know that this weapon can, this, you know, cyber warfare, it can be weaponized. And once that happens, all bets are off, and we don't know the reach that cyber warfare can have. So this is about alerting people to what's at stake here.
You've been around pop culture basically your entire life, right, and involved in various different roles. Are you surprised in the way that it has not caught the popular imagination more outside of the sort of political imagination from what you see, what you know of how people consume things?
Yes. And I think a large part of it is, again, we go back to fake news. When you have the leader of the free world saying that the New York Times, CNN, various other news outlets are fake, it tends to confuse people as to what is really real and what really actually happened. And we were a divided country long before this happened, and now we are even more divided. And I believe that's why Putin was been so successful. He found a crease.
One of the things you said was that people who are not talking about what Russia did are not being patriotic. So, right?
It's not that they're not being patriotic. I think if they understood what happened and they accepted the reality of what happened, of course they'd be patriotic. Because who doesn't want America to survive and be safe and secure? And who doesn't want, on a philosophical level, to have democracy, the beacon that we always talk about, the shining city on the hill? Who doesn't want that to proliferate and throughout the world?
So what's President Trump's issue in your mind?
Well, I can only guess. I don't know for sure, but I can.
You're not best friends with Donald Trump.
I'm not best friends with him, although I have met him. I
did. When did you meet him?
I met him years ago. There was a heavyweight fight at one of his casinos in Atlantic City, and I was with Billy Crystal, and we said hello. We met. We talked for a little bit.
So this would have been in the 90s at some point.
I don't know. It was Mike Tyson.
Okay.
Against
pre-prison Mike Tyson.
Yeah, right? Against one of the, I can't remember who he was fighting, but it was a knockout in 91 seconds.
It's you, Billy Crystal, and Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Ringside for title?
No, we weren't. It wasn't like that. We just met him prior to the fight. You know, we talked with him for a little while. We met him at the hotel.
And what do you remember of that?
Well, the only thing I remember is that I have, worked with people who have the biggest egos in the world, you know, actors. They have huge egos, and you know, politicians have egos too. You wouldn't go into that profession, whether it's an actor or a politician, unless you had a need to be liked.
Right.
You know, and I've never met somebody with as big an ego. I couldn't believe it. You know, he's meeting new people. He's meeting Billy. I mean, seeing Billy, he's meeting me, and yet it's only about him. And so I thought, wow, that's interesting. I mean, he's a, I mean, I understand he's got his name on everything, but he really is only interested
in
himself.
But how did that play out? Just in the conversation?
Yes.
So he's only talking about himself?
Just in the conversation. Everything that we talked about came back to him. It always came back to him, you know.
So like City Slickers came back
to him. It doesn't matter what we talked about. Came right back to him.
What I was asking about is what, how to explain that President Trump is where he is on.
Yeah, I like I say, I can only surmise that he is concerned about being delegitimized and thinking that, you know, even if he had nothing to do with you know, collusion or anything like that, he still would think that, you know, somebody put the thumb on the scale for him and that he didn't win legitimately. And the fact is, he did lose the popular vote by 3 million votes. So if you add in the Russians helped him out and whatever, then he can say, well, I, you know, in his mind, he can think I didn't win. And you can see when he tweets out all the time, it's always about talking about how big his victory was and how he, you know, beat Hillary and da 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 da. And so I think that's probably the reason. Now, there may be other nefarious things, which is he doesn't want to be found out that he, in fact, did collude. And we don't know that, and that we will discover.
When I talk to Democratic operatives in Washington, around the country, what they say is, we got to stop talking about Russia. Stop talking about Russia. People don't want to talk about Russia. You want to talk more about Russia.
Yeah, because I'm not talking about it from a standpoint of a Democratic operative or somebody who's trying to bolster the Democratic Party. I think they're probably right when they talk about the midterm elections, because most of these, they're local races and they're, you know, statewide races, and most of the people are not concerned with and because they can't feel it, because they can't see it, they're not concerned. They don't think of it as a national security issue. They don't think that their lives are somehow in jeopardy. So, you know, the Democratic Party wants to focus on the things that people care about. They want to care about jobs. They care about their health care and so on, their taxes. So that's what they want to focus in on. But what I'm talking about is not a Democrat or Republican idea. And that's why I've reached across the aisle. And I, you know, launched this thing yesterday with David Frum. I've talked with Max Boot, James Clapper, Charlie Sykes. I mean, these people are Republicans, and they care about the same things that I care about in a larger sense, which is the health of America.
So it's a website that will have more and more information on it as you go. What's the editorial process for what you decide to put on there, how it's presented?
Well, we're looking at what we consider to be reputable news sources. I mean, there New York Times and Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Reuters has done some great work. McClatchy has done great work. Politico has done.
I was going to say, you were about to leave.
No, I wouldn't leave Politico out. No, and even Fox. Even Fox. I mean, there are certain people, you know, Brett Baer has done some really good reporting. So has Shepard Smith. I mean, we're looking at, you know, legitimate news sources that have, you know, it's not, we're not going to have Alex Jones on there. We're not going
to
have.
I feel like he would not have to say what you want him to say about.
You know, he's allowed to say whatever he wants. It's a free country, and we have this.
And he
wild,
does say whatever he wants.
And we have this Wild West internet, but there has to be, you know, rules of journalism and how things are sourced. I love the fact that when you read something either in the New York Times or Washington Post or any of the good sources, you'll see that they will have sourced 5, 7, 9 people that were, you know, present during right. a, you know, that to me it makes
a different standard.
Yes, it's a different standard.
But so you're doing some of the deciding about what gets in.
Well,
what,
you know, if you think of it, you know, I'm on the board of advisors.
Right.
So I mean, we set a certain amount of standard. We do have an editor that works on this, and she's terrific. Her name is Jackie Schechner,
mm-hmm.
and I, you know, she'll run things by me. I mean, all of the content that you see, you know, the various key players and so on. I look at all this stuff to, you know, I mean, we have Russian experts that weigh in on this that say, hey, that's wrong. You know, you shouldn't be saying that, or you should be saying that. We actually got caught in something yesterday where they, we had a bio of Kislyak,
mm-hmm.
Sergei Kislyak.
The former Russian ambassador to the U.S.
Former Russian right. ambassador to the U.S. And we said ambassador to the U.S. didn't have the word former in there. Mm-hmm. And somebody caught us on that. And we put it right in there, you know. So
you've cared about politics and been involved in politics for a long time. When you think about what happened, what we know of what happened and what you think may still be out there about Russia and the political reaction to it, what does it do to you in your sense of what it is to think about it yourself as a politically active person?
Well, I mean, I made this joke before, but, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I was the first generation that experienced the Cold War and the nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union. And we did these what they call duck and cover mm-hmm. drills, which you had to, you know, when the siren went off, you had to run under your school desk
right.
to protect yourself. And you,
is
we
your
never,
school desk in the Bronx?
Well, there was the Bronx, and then there was in New Rochelle, you know, where I was in New Rochelle. But it was funny because you never, as a kid, you don't question that this is. But as an adult, I grew up and I thought, I wonder if the material they made school desks out of could actually withstand a nuclear bomb.
Probably not.
Although maybe there was special material they used.
I remember I grew up in New York also, and in the apartment building that I grew up in, there was a sign that said for the bomb shelter that at one point they just threw out and I kept. But I don't know where the bomb shelter was in the building. I have a feeling that it probably would not have kept me safe. I assume in the basement of the building, certainly not a school desk.
In the basement of the building. No. And people did build bomb shelters in their backyards, you know, in the suburbs. So I grew up with all this. And the idea that, you know, we could be somehow obliterated by a foreign power is something that I was raised as. I lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was 16 years old when that happened. Actually, 15. I was 15 years old. And we were frightened. We were really frightened that we could be obliterated. So understanding that and understanding the capacity, the ultimate capacity of cyber warfare, that's what, you know, galvanizes me into action.
You put your own money into this?
I did.
How much money are we talking?
You know, we didn't start out with...
It's maybe a rude question to ask.
No, it's okay. We didn't start out with a lot. I mean, you know, I think at this point we have like 100,000 in or something. I know we'll probably put more in as is needed. At a certain point, the end goal would be to have some kind of, you know, like a 9/11 commission, a bipartisan commission to be formed to make an assessment of what actually happened and what can be done, mm-hmm. if anything, in terms of laws, regulations, or anything in terms of how we can make ourselves more secure. So, you know, when that happens, then we don't need the site. Hopefully, right. we won't need the site, you know, soon.
Here's the reason why I'm asking. You are a person who you've been obviously done a lot in the entertainment world, but you've also been politically active for a long time and getting involved personally and financially with causes, anti-smoking, with Proposition 8 in California. I wonder what you think about at this moment where we see so many celebrities and Hollywood people who are opposed to President Trump, but who are just sort of sounding off at award shows. What do they need to do to get to where you think it actually has an impact?
Well, you know, you ask a really good question because I get attacked all the time for being a celebrity, you know, and what gives you a right to speak out, and you're just a celebrity, and why should we bother listening to you and all that? And the fact is, if I didn't steep myself in the things that I was talking about, then you shouldn't listen to me any more than anybody else. Celebrities are really, for the most part, only good for shining a spotlight on a particular issue. Beyond that, if you want to try to move that issue forward in any kind of meaningful way, you really have to take the time to understand it and understand how to go about doing that. So, you know, people who don't know a lot about me don't know that I did work in the government for 7 years. I had a job, a position in California government to oversee the implementation of early childhood education, early childhood development, which is an initiative I passed in 1998 with a 50-cent tax on tobacco that raised at that time $750 million. Now it's down to about $500 million a year, and I oversaw that commission that implemented that program. So I do understand how the nexus between a policy, politics, and government. And you do have to understand all those things before you just throw something out there, because you're not going to move the ball forward unless you understand the nexus between government, policy, and politics. And if you can understand that, and you also happen to be a celebrity, that's a good combination. And, you know, unfortunately, we do listen to celebrities more than we should. I would point to the President of the United States right now. This is a person who is not steeped in policy, is not steeped in government, but is a celebrity, and people, and you know, to use that, you know, the cliche, it trumps everything. I mean, you know, to you know,
that's a convenient word in this.
Yes, it is.
There is, but when you look at the a lot of what's coming out of the entertainment industry, the Emmys were the latest time that people made this complaint. Is that they say, well, you know, it's so anti-Trump, it's just everybody's against him, and it fractures the country even more to do that. Do you think that that's right, or do you think that there's a need for people to use that kind of a stage or whatever stage they have?
I think people have to, you know, it's tough because the lines have been so blurred over the years. It's for people to understand the difference between entertainment and people are actually trying to do something.
Right.
Entertainment is fair game to make fun of anybody. You know, I mean, to look at you know, the late night hosts and the comics now, this is like gold mine. You know, Trump is a gold mine because he's easy to make fun of and all that. But you have to. There's only so much to that. That's entertainment.
Right.
That's not about. You're asking the question whether it divides us more or not. And I would suggest that that doesn't divide us. What divides us is the people who are running the show. They'll divide us more than the comedians. Now, you look at the Emmys. You mentioned the Emmys, and you had Sean Spicer on there. And, you know, Melissa McCarthy was great, making a lot of fun of him on Saturday Night Live. But putting him on the Emmy broadcast, as funny or not funny as that might be, that is us doing a disservice because we're blurring the lines even more. Mm-hmm. We're saying that guy, it's okay that guy lied. We're normalizing that. And I think the media and everybody has a responsibility for having normalized a lot of the behavior that we've seen coming out of Donald Trump, the candidate, and Donald Trump, the president. It's so outrageous, and it's so pervasive, and it's so ongoing that we don't stop and go, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You can't have somebody hitting somebody in the back with a golf ball and thinking that's okay. That's promoting violence. That's not okay. Yeah. It may be okay for a comedian, but it's not okay for the leader of the free world.
What about from the perspective of writing checks? It seems to me like there is more money in Hollywood among people who support progressive democratic causes or oppose President Trump than there is, let's say, that the Koch brothers have, right? If people started, if a lot of the people who had these things to say were writing a check for $10,000, $100,000, $1 million, that's a lot of money very quickly, right? Do you think that there needs to be that kind of a shift in the way that people look at this?
Well, first of all, we've been talking about campaign finance reform forever. And right. unless there's some constitutional way to overturn Buckley-Vallejo, we're not going to have that because we've had the ruling on Citizens United. And, you know, I don't know that you'll ever get the money out of politics. Yeah. But if you're talking about, Hollywood and where they put their money, and you're right, for the most part, it goes into the Democratic Party. It goes into liberal causes. But the one thing nobody ever talks about is Hollywood doesn't ask for anything.
Yeah.
We're
but
not
it doesn't,
asking. I mean,
it doesn't
except
go,
for, except it, for, you know, maybe intellectual property rights or piracy or those kinds of things. You're not really influencing and saying, well, we need you to do this and that. You
but
know?
I guess my point is it's also not coming in like huge numbers, right? When I was covering Obama when he was president, he would go on fundraising swings through through L.A. Mm-hmm. And often, we were in Gwyneth Paltrow's backyard. Oh, in Shonda Rhimes' backyard. These were giant fundraisers mm-hmm. That would bring in, I don't know, several hundred thousand dollars, maybe a couple million
right.
points. But it seems like there is a huge amount of cash there that, because the campaign finance laws won't be changed anytime soon, it doesn't look like,
right.
that if people wanted to write bigger checks, they could, and influence the conversation in a different way.
Yes, absolutely. And like you say, the Koch brothers do the same
right.
thing, and there's probably a lot more money from certain individuals on the Republican side than there is on the Democrat.
I mean, the Kochs is like $1 billion, let's say, in any midterm cycle.
Right.
That's about what it comes to.
Right.
There's $1 billion in Hollywood, isn't there,
for
Democrats?
I don't know if there's a... There might be $1 billion in Hollywood.
Yeah, there's a cumulatively...
But there's
like,
not like a $1 billion guy.
No. That's what I'm saying. There's people.
Yeah,
right?
yeah. There's a lot of money. I don't know if it's a billion. There's a lot of money
right.
in Hollywood. There's no question about it. But what the people of Hollywood are asking for is to protect the environment, to accept climate change, to have universal health care, to expand education opportunities, to have minimum wage raised. There are a lot of democratic ideas that are promoted, but they don't ask for anything
right.
in return. They're not saying, you know, if you then do those things, you know, we have a representative
right.
in Washington. The Chris Dodd is there now.
Mm-hmm.
We've had
left.
Oh
right?
yeah, that's right. He just left. But I'm saying, you know, over the years,
yeah.
the MPAA,
sure.
We've always had somebody. But the things that we advocate are like basically don't steal our stuff. You know.
Which,
yeah.
there's something to that.
Yeah.
But I guess the example that comes up in my mind, whatever you think of him one way or the other, is when in 2012, Bill Maher wrote the $1 million check to
right.
Obama. Now, it seems like part of why he wrote that check was to make a big deal out of the fact that he wrote a $1 million check. But I just wonder whether there should be, you think there should be a more of a move to put more money in from the people who care so much about
these issues. Thinking there should be more money. Oh,
well,
like,
I mean,
you're making the argument.
As a counterweight, if
yeah.
right, like if there's the complaint about what is going on from the kinds of politics that the Koch brothers promote, and the knowledge that the campaign finance laws aren't changing, is there money that should be there as a counterweight?
I mean, it would be good if there is, but again, you know, when somebody can write
about a billion dollar check. But they also have
there's
a network of people,
I
right?
understand, and there's nobody that can.
Sure.
I try to explain to people and the relative value of money. I mean, I tell this story all the time. I mean, there's nobody that has that kind of money in Hollywood. You know, there are levels of
sure, but
of
if so,
people,
this
you know,
one has $1 million and this one has $500,000 and this one has $2 million.
Yeah, but it still doesn't get to $1 billion. You
it
need,
takes a while.
You need a thousand millions to get there. It's hard.
I feel like there are 1,000 people with $1 million to spare
yeah,
in Hollywood who care about
there
Democratic
are,
issues.
But they don't have that. I mean, you know, you keep putting $1 million,
yeah.
million. You want, you know, there are people who have $100 million. There's a big difference between $100 million. It may not be to the regular guy, but that and billions,
right.
you know, there's a big difference.
Yeah, it's when I covered Mike Bloomberg when he was mayor.
Well, there
here.
You go. That's a perfect example.
Right. There was a question once of whether his worth was $20 billion or $30 billion.
No, once you're in those numbers,
he's,
once you're in those numbers, you're, you know, you don't have to.
You have a new movie on LBJ coming out. The person who plays LBJ is someone that I don't think most people would expect, is Woody Harrelson.
Right.
How did you come to thinking Woody Harrelson is the right person to play Lyndon Johnson?
Well, that's a great question because I get that all the time. People say, you know, I don't see Woody Harrelson. How? Why would you pick Woody Harrelson? First of all, wait till you see the movie.
I've seen the preview.
He's incredible. I mean, absolutely. The reason I picked him is, first of all, he's from Texas. Secondly, I wanted to have a more full-rounded picture of who LBJ was. And everybody knows the aggressive bull in the china shop, arm-twisting, larger-than-life LBJ, who was certainly that in getting legislation passed, which he was brilliant at. But there was also a very emotional and insecure and sensitive side to him that people didn't get to see. And I knew that with Woody Harrelson, I would be able to, and also sense of humor, that you would be able to show the character in a much more full-rounded light.
You do have a scene of him with the toilet.
We have a few scenes where it's funny. I mean, some of it's very funny.
How is doing that movie? You've done, it's not the first movie you've done, it's not the first time that you've touched on politics, but I guess most directly, right? Like this one?
Well, I mean, the American President, right, we did, and Ghosts of Mississippi.
Right, and in a different way, with a few good men. Right? How does it change your perspective on politics and government to do that?
Well, you know what happens? My experience in government and my experience in the political world changes my view of how to make those films. I mean, that's what's changed, and that's what actually allowed me to make LBJ, because I was of draft age during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. I hated LBJ. I mean, he was my enemy. I mean, he could have sent me to my death. So I didn't like him at all, and it was only as I got older and spent more time in the political circles and in government and understanding what it takes to do what he was able to do. And I've said many times, and other people, and it's nothing new, but I mean, had it not been for the Vietnam War, he would have gone down as one of the great presidents of all time.
Yeah, because that's sort of like saying,
well, I know you can't take that away. You can't take that away, obviously. Right. But I mean, if you look from a domestic standpoint,
sure. Which is where you're focused, right? Like the film is focused.
Yeah, it's focused on his ascension to power with the assassination of JFK and his transition to becoming president and embracing the Civil Rights Act that he helped pass.
Let me ask you a director question in a different way. What kind of performer do you think Donald Trump is? Is he a good performer?
Well, he, they always say that Washington is Hollywood for ugly people, you know. So he's not an ugly person in the way he comes across. I mean, you may not like the way in which he talks about women or minorities, and that's ugly. But I mean, he has a persona, and he has a charisma. I'll give you a story. My wife, Michelle, who is a professional photographer, she took the photo that's on the cover of the book, The Art of the Deal. Mm-hmm. And this is way, way back when. And at one point, they were up on this high rise that he was constructing, and they were going to take the pictures overlooking Central Park. And the wind was blowing, and he said, I got to get this hairspray. You know, I need this special hairspray. So they went downstairs to get it. And when they walked, down the street, people going, hey, Donald. He was always larger than life, and he was always attractive in that, charismatic celebrity way. So, I think that it matters. All that stuff matters. You know, there's a reason why Kennedy beat Nixon. You know, if people heard that debate, they think Nixon won the debate. The people saw the debate. Right. Kennedy won that debate. So.
Did your wife ever find out what was in the special hairspray?
Well, I think it's still there, whatever it is. I don't think he ever washes it, though. It stays there. It's stuck in place.
But he's good as a performer.
He's not, I mean, as an actor, no. As a politician who has to perform in front of a certain type of audience, yes, he works. I mean, I don't think he's, let's say, he's not for every audience.
One thing that struck me as I was thinking about other movies that you did, and very famously, right? Spinal Tap is one of yours. He's good as an improv guy, right? He does a lot riffing and just takes off. What do you make of him as an improviser?
Well, he can improvise. Let's put it this way. He has a range of like A to A, not quite to B. He's like in a very small range, because if you look at his impersonations that he does of people mocking him, it's the same. He does it exactly the same. His fingers go in the same direction. His voice goes in the same direction. And he has certain stock phrases that he goes to. So
but
it's
he can
not
do like 90 minutes without any notes almost.
Yeah,
right?
He can do 90 minutes without any notes. And it's easy if you don't say anything. You know, if you don't say anything of substance, you can kind of, you know, riff around. But I'm, like I say, it's a small range that he has.
I will tell you that one of the things that I have noticed in Washington has become somewhat of a almost cliche at this point is people say, it's a Spinal Tap reference, they say, well, you can't, the people who are outraged, they say, well, you can't always be at 11.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So that's what you brought to the Donald Trump political discourse.
Well, yeah, no, the biggest compliment I ever got on the This Goes to 11, years ago, I was at some party, I can't remember what it was, but Elon Musk, you know, who created the Tesla, he had the first Tesla, and he drove up with it, you know? And it was like, well, what's this car? You know, we never seen a car like this. And he says, here, I want to show you something. And he brings me over to the car, and I sit down in the car, and he turns the volume of the radio up, and it goes to 11. And he said, I love the movie. I decided to make the volume go to 11. And it's in there. It's in every Tesla. Right. Also, the air conditioning that goes to 11.
Right. One little bit that is just...
Yeah, no. To me is the greatest 11.
All right, last question here. You, I think I know the answer to this, but you have been, in the past, there was speculation about you running for office yourself. We did one of these with Schwarzenegger a little while back. So there was the thought that you'd run against him in 06. You didn't.
There was. And actually, I considered it. I mean, I had passed, the tobacco tax, and I was looking to pass another initiative to create universal preschool, and that was to be done with raising state taxes back to the level that it was at during the Reagan and the Pete Wilson administrations. And I got a lot of heat for that. And I think what happened was people saw that I might have the ability to get these things done by raising. So now, as it turns out, Governor Brown did exactly what I did, but he put it into the general funds and was able, because the state was in terrible trouble at the time and he needed to right the ship. And he did exactly what I did. He looked at that same tax and was able to pass it. But I thought about it, you know, I thought, could I get things done? I mean, is there a way to get things done? What's the best way to get things done? And I sat with my family. I'm not joking. This is a true thing. I sat with my family. I have three kids. They were young at the time. And we discussed it. And I basically polled 40% in my own family. And I figured if I couldn't pull my family, I figured maybe I shouldn't.
But that's done.
No. And then I discover you can get a lot done, not in elected office.
All right. Rob Reiner, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.